11, the faith chapter, and it does talk a lot about faith in Hebrews 11 and describes and names those who, because of their faith, resulted in conquering nations, conquering sin, overcoming all that stood in the way of God's will. But I consider this the faith chapter because I consider this the chapter that brings into the equation for salvation where faith really belongs. Oftentimes faith is portrayed that which Christians need to get and add to themselves or to their experience or exercise in order to do things beyond which Christians are supposed to do. The idea in drawing from the studies of faith in other places is that, okay, here's a Christian, he's been born again, he's been saved, he's been justified. And the way sometimes faith is portrayed is, okay, now we've got this Christian, he trusts God, he loves God, he's justified. Now he has to find a way to get faith in order to overcome fear and overcome the devil and overcome the world. And he's got all these obstacles in front of him and all these failings in front of him. He's got to get the faith to overcome those things. And that's how sometimes it is portrayed. But here in chapter 4, that kind of faith is entry-level faith. It is the kind of faith that justified Abraham. And here in chapter 4, if you're looking for some place in the Bible that tells you exactly what that faith consists in, it's here in chapter 4 of Romans. You can read a lot of other places about faith and get an understanding of what it might be, but what is the object of faith? Remember last week I said there can be no faith until you have an object of faith. Thus that thing is sort of a faith machine sitting there with its engines running, full of faith, in neutral, waiting for an object to trust in. It's really not that. Until you have an object, you do not have faith. There can be no faith without an object of faith. In fact, that is one of the necessary conditions to faith, is that there must be knowledge or light that is an object of faith. So nobody believes God unless they have some knowledge of God. An object of faith. Light. Understanding. Synonyms for the same idea. Knowledge, light, understanding, an object of faith. So until somebody has some idea, some knowledge of God, then if they say, well, I have faith in God or I trust God, what do you trust God? What is it about God you trust? Well, I don't know. I don't have any ideas about God. I just trust God. That is nonsense. That is meaningless. So that is not faith. Faith has to have an object. Now, I will jump ahead just to show you Abraham's object, and we will get to it in its time. Verse 21 of chapter 4 tells us exactly the state of mind and the object of faith for Abraham. Verse 21, chapter 4. Being fully assured that what he, God, had promised, he was able also to perform. He had full assurance that what God had promised, he was also able to perform. In other words, the object of Abraham's faith and full assurance is God, that God would not promise something that he would not perform, and that God also had the ability to perform it. The promise of God in Abraham's mind was the object of faith, and the God who made the promise is included in his object of faith. But we will come to develop that in its proper place. But that was the object of Abraham's faith. Now, Paul brings in Abraham here at this juncture, beginning with chapter 4, as an enlargement of what he means when he says in chapter 3 that we maintain that we are justified by faith. He maintains that. He declared that in chapter 3. Now he's going to describe what he means by faith. That is that which we are justified by is faith. What does he mean by faith? He makes his declaration. James is also a writer who makes a lot of interesting discussions about faith. When Paul says, apart from law, we maintain that God justifies the sinner apart from law, the Jews are going, wait a minute. This faith stuff, I don't understand. Just you believe something and are you throwing the law out? Paul, where's the law? You're throwing the law out. And Paul says at the end of chapter 3, on the contrary, we establish the law. Just wait, he says. I will demonstrate to you why the law is not thrown out. In fact, why the law is established when God justifies a sinner by faith. Now, I should be very careful in maintaining what Paul says, and that is we are justified by faith. That is the shorthand for saying that we are justified as a gift by His grace through faith. That's really Paul's formula. You're justified freely as a gift by His grace through our believing or our faith. So our faith doesn't justify us. It's God who justifies us. His grace, His willingness to treat us as if we had never sinned, His willingness to forgive all debts of sin, all transgressions of sin, freely as a gift because of His grace, and through the instrument or the means of our believing this promise of God. There's where all the components should come together. So if somebody were to start reading chapter 4, oh my, Abraham was justified not by works but by faith. Wonderful. The mind would go off on a wrong tack and begin to believe that man has no relationship to God's law, and they would begin to believe that just wrong things about justification. Because where Paul starts in chapter 4 only makes sense if somebody has read chapters 1, 2, and 3 and gotten the effect upon their heart and mind that it should have. So, if you were a Jew or a Gentile, and we had all of the studies we've had together all at once, then our hearts would be prepared properly to apply what he starts off in chapter 4 saying. His readers are people who have heard him say that Gentiles are under a law of their own mind and reason whereby they know through creation, through their own understanding, that there is a creator, that they owe to their neighbor as much good as they would do to themselves, and that they are a law to themselves even if they have not heard of the law of Moses. And God will judge them according to this law that the Gentiles have, and if they have violated that law, then God will judge them by that law. Then he turned to the Jews in chapter 3 and said, now the Jews who have such an enlargement of understanding of law and the law of God revealed through Moses, they have a much larger understanding, therefore they had much more responsibility and will be judged by a greater light. And then he concludes by demonstrating that the Gentiles had not lived up to the light that was revealed in their reason, and the Jews had not lived up to the light that was revealed through Moses. Therefore, he concludes, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Now, when the mind is in a willingness to see and acknowledge the truth of that, both as Jewish or Gentile readers, if they would be willing to have honestly looked at what Paul said and acknowledge, yes, I have not done that which I know I ought to have done, and under the law of my own mind, or under the law revealed through Moses, I know I have violated that law. And with a proper understanding of law, once you have violated law, you cannot make up for it by obeying law thereafter. That will make up for it. Your obedience to law thereafter is what you're required to do thereafter. You cannot do more than what is required of you. So Jew and Gentile would have concluded with Paul, yes, I have sinned. I have come short of the glory of God. What is my remedy? Paul declares that God's remedy is that God justifies the sinner as a gift because of His grace to those who trust God. In that context, then a discussion of what it means to trust God can be laid out and given proper understanding. In trusting God, we're going to look at this morning at faith and unbelief. Faith is not what happens in your feelings or sensibilities or your desires or hope. Many people confuse the desire to trust God, knowing that they must trust God, as if it were trusting God. But it is just a desire, an involuntary response to knowledge. Some people consider feelings of fondness towards God as trusting God. As we discussed last week, some people confuse the conditions of faith with faith itself. And one of the conditions of faith is knowledge, so that people confuse knowing something with believing it. This I find to be a major obstacle in people's development towards faith in God, is that they have great knowledge that they have stored up, and they think that is believing. But it is only knowledge. As we said last week, knowledge is a necessary condition in order to have faith, but knowledge is not the faith. You cannot have faith without knowledge. And that knowledge must be according to truth, not just any knowledge. It must be according to truth. Then there can be faith. However, once a person has knowledge of the truth, that person will be in one of two states. He will be in a state of faith or in a state of unbelief. The mind is a marvelous thing that God has made. God has made every person's mind so wonderfully because it cannot remain neutral or in a state of just idling, if you will, when it hears the truth. Isn't that marvelous? God has made us in such a way that when we hear the truth, we are forced to have to concur with it, agree to it, live according to it, or our minds must shut down its influence upon us and suppress this knowledge of the truth. Wonderful. We just can't stand in the middle and just sort of look at truth go by one way or the other and remain neutral to it. That's marvelous, because when we will take the truth and start feeding our minds with it, with a willingness to believe it, it will have an influence upon us. We can't remain neutral to it. So it's a marvelous gift that God has given the mind, that the more truth it hears, if it's in a state of willingness to believe, the more influence it has upon us. I thank God for that, because we shall have an eternal influence upon our minds if we are in a state of belief, and if we are in heaven, because we will have access to eternally to more and more truth upon our minds. And being in the state of confidence in God, it shall have a great influence, an increasing influence upon our minds. I believe that's what Paul means when he says, grow in the grace and knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. If you trust God, every time you hear His truth, it has an influence upon your mind, upon your heart, upon your life. A person who trusts God doesn't have to decide to have the Word and the truth have an influence upon him. It will. What makes the difference is what starts at the beginning. Does a person accept the truth, receive it, submit to it, believe it, or does he reject it? The conditions for unbelief, one of the conditions is the same as faith. And that is that one of the conditions of unbelief is knowledge. Unbelief is not the absence of faith. Unbelief is not ignorance. If you are ignorant of something, it doesn't mean you do not believe it. It means you're ignorant. Unbelief is when you learn a truth and then refuse to believe it, refuse to accept it. That's unbelief. So unbelief is not ignorance. Faith is not ignorance. Faith is the receiving of truth. And unbelief is the rejection of truth. A person can have a great deal of knowledge, and if their state of mind is to reject that truth, then they are rejecting great knowledge, great light.
Isn't that interesting? Let us see that distinction clearly. Two people can have the same degree of knowledge. One can be in a state of belief and faith, and the other can be in a state of unbelief. And the two can talk and share their knowledge. They can have equal amounts of knowledge. But one would be in a state of faith, one would be in a state of unbelief. Let us learn, then, that knowledge and faith are not the same thing. Ignorance is not unbelief. Knowledge is not faith. But many times people confuse that and think that knowledge is, therefore, an evidence of faith. No, it's not. Unbelief is a manifestation of selfishness. Unbelief is a manifestation of selfishness. It is the unwillingness to give up self-interest when truth promotes or provides to the mind great reasons and great influences to give up selfishness. Unbelief is obstinate selfishness. Unbelief picks and chooses truth to receive and accept. Truths that the mind, the selfish mind, believes can't further his selfish interests. But it is not a state of mind that receives all truth openly. It picks and chooses things that may be truth, may not be, but it is only selective in that this will further my selfish ends. I'll believe that, but they don't receive truth as truth for its own sake. It is only chosen for its selfish ends. Think of Judas. Judas was willing to believe some things about Jesus, but he did not receive Jesus. He did not receive all that was true about Jesus. Because if he did, he would not have betrayed him. Could not have betrayed him. But he did receive some things that were true about Jesus. He didn't deny that he saw wine, water turned into wine. He believed that because he saw that. He believed it. Didn't deny the miracles that he saw. But he did deny all that was true about Jesus for selfish interests. So the selfish mind will pick and choose what truths to believe and pat itself on the back for believing some truths. Unbelief implies a state of present total depravity. The subject of total depravity is defined by some people that the man is so depraved, he has a physical body that is depraved and guilty of sin. His mind is so depraved as a result of being the child of Adam that he cannot perceive truth. His will is so depraved that he cannot choose to believe God. That the mind is so depraved it cannot believe truth, cannot understand truth. Therefore, salvation consists in God giving man faith, giving him belief, giving him understanding, giving him all the things that he needs for salvation because he is so depraved. He has not the ability to understand truth or receive truth or believe truth. And in some people's view of total depravity. And they insist that it is not total depravity unless the mind and the body are so depraved and guilty of sin that they are unable to do anything that is good. Inability is a key factor in the idea of total depravity in some people's views. But total depravity must be a moral issue, not a physical issue. Otherwise, it could not be sin. Nothing that is physical or under a law of necessity is sin. Only that which involves a choice. So depravity must involve a choice. Total depravity is true, but it is total moral depravity. That is, it is the mind's and heart's rejection of all the truth it presently knows. If a person rejects all the truth they presently know, They cannot, in that state, be more guilty than anybody else. Let me say it a different way. When a person is in unbelief, they are rejecting truth. And you cannot be any less guilty than in that state. And try to say it another way. Unbelief implies a degree of wickedness as great as is possible for the time being. It is not possible to be more wicked than when you are in a state of unbelief, because you are rejecting all known truth. It's not possible to be more wicked at that time than that person actually is. To reject all known truth puts a person in a state whereby he could not be possibly more wicked at that moment by any other action he may take than his rejection of truth. How could he be more wicked? His wickedness could only increase if he had more knowledge and rejected that too. Total depravity is total rejection of all the truth that one knows. And it's not possible to be more wicked than that, because wickedness is rejection of light. The only way to increase one's wickedness is to give them more light. And if they reject that also, then they have increased their wickedness at the time. So it's not possible to say to a person or think of another person or yourself that, well, I am in unbelief, but I could be worse than I am. No. To reject the truth is to be as wicked for that moment as you possibly could be. Because outward actions are not what is virtue and vice. It is the state of the heart, its relationship to truth. Unbelief, and on the other side, when you are in a state of faith in God, when you do trust Him, when you do receive all the light that you have before your mind, you are in a state of holiness before God, of which in that moment it is not possible to be any more holy than that. Why do I say that? Holiness is obedience to all known truth. If one is obedient to all known truth, living according to it with their heart, it is not possible for them to be more holy or more obedient to the truth unless they had more light. So the person in unbelief could not be more wicked than he is at that moment unless he had more light added to him. And the person who trusts God and receives all the truth that God has manifest to that person's mind at the time, if they receive that and walk according to that, they could not be more holy at that moment. Could not possibly be more holy than they were at the time. Do you see the principle? Think that through? Ask me questions about it if you don't understand it. Unbelief is supreme enmity to God. Unbelief is mortal enmity to God. Unbelief would wrestle God to the ground and kill Him if He could. Because God is the God of truth. And truth reveals to every sinner's mind his obligation to love God and to love his neighbor as himself. And the selfish, unbelieving mind refuses to accept that as an obligation and refuses to accept the God who revealed it and gave it. So it would, if it could, kill God, dethrone God. It's God stands opposed to him. Why is it that unbelief would do that? Because unbelief knows that there is a creator. His mind is made by God, and he knows he ought to love his neighbor as himself. And his willingness to only seek his own good, the action of the mind that commits itself to that in light of these things, it must therefore reject these truths that its mind knows. And the rejection of truth is unbelief. That's what we mean by unbelief, rejection of truth. Unbelief implies charging God with being a liar. God says, love Him supremely, love your neighbor as yourself. Unbelief says, by its living, by its state in which it is in, I will not accept that to be true. What I accept to be true is my own good is the supreme good and worth living for, and I have a right to do so. So therefore, God must be lying when He tells me to do otherwise. It is, in effect, calling God a liar. In fact, that's what John says in 1 John. He that believeth not God hath made him a liar. Unbelief is calling God a liar. Unbelief, as Hebrews 3:12 or 15 says, is what is in the evil heart, it says. An evil, unbelieving heart. Unbelief, a state of mind of unbelief, one is at war with their own mind. They are at war with their own reason. Imagine that. A man's conscience is his worst enemy. He is at war not only with God, the author of truth, the proclaimer of truth, the God of truth. He is at war with his own reason, his own conscience. His reason affirms his obligation to love others, love God supremely. His conscience affirms his obligation to do that and pronounces judgment upon himself. And the unbelieving person, the unbelief is in rejecting even his own mind's affirmation of his obligation. He's at war with his own reason, his own conscience that affirms the law of God in his own being. A person in unbelief is at war with himself, is at war with his neighbor, is at war with God. That is the state of one who is in unbelief. Now, this might be hard to comprehend if your idea of unbelief is ignorance. But if we realize that the definition of unbelief is rejection of truth, then we see unbelief's guilt. There must be first a knowledge of truth that is rejected, and that is unbelief. What is the sinner rejecting? What is the selfish mind rejecting? What is unbelief rejecting? One's own reason, the workings of one's own conscience, one's own perception of the creation and all that implies, and the knowledge of God through the Scriptures and through the Gospel and through Jesus. Whatever knowledge comes to a person from those degrees, those places, the sinner is at war with. And unbelief implies the will's embracing of all opposite errors and lies. To live in unbelief is to live in a state of living by lies. Is that not just a reasonable conclusion? If unbelief is rejection of truth, then what a person lives by cannot be the truth. Therefore, it must be a lie. Isn't that what Eve faced? She lived by the truth, as Adam did. And the devil came along and planted, gave to her a suggestion and a temptation to stop believing what was true about God, which she could only therefore end up believing what is a lie. Hath God said? Has He said this, really? Why, He knows something that He didn't tell you. He knows that it would be good for you to eat of that fruit, and you would obtain something you don't presently have, and that which you could obtain, which you presently don't have, is something that's really good for you, but God doesn't love you because He's held back something that's really good for you. Is that true? That's a lie, isn't it? But she had to believe that before she would ever disobey God. That's unbelief, to accept a lie. In rejecting the truth, one must accept an idea that is contrary to the truth. Unbelief is living according to lies, that which is a lie. A terrible, terrible state to live in. Be at war with your own conscience, your own reason, the creation around you, your neighbor, and live according to what is a lie instead of the truth. Yet the sinner, yet myself, I'm trying to tell myself that I was okay, deceived myself in thinking I believed God because I knew a lot about God. I didn't really understand what trusting Him really meant. And that's another distinction between what is faith and not faith, and that is to believe in God is not to believe God. To believe in God is not to believe God. To believe in God is to make God an idea, but not a person. To believe God is to recognize Him as a person who has revealed Himself and revealed His will. And to believe Him is to respond to a person and not just to hold an idea in one's intellect. Faith in God and is, here's the trick with words, okay? We don't have to faith. We don't have the verb to faith. So when we use faith in relationship with God, we always have to say faith in God, which leads to the idea of believing in God. But faith in God is the only way we can use the word faith in connection with God. But it leaves the idea of trusting in God as opposed to trusting God. You say to your children, don't you make the distinction with your children that they should trust you, not just trust in you? They should also trust you. So the words trust and believing are more appropriate to use. Believing God, trusting God. When we use the word faith, we have to use in. We might say we're going to faith God, but that's not a good word to use that way. It doesn't construct right. But in our understanding of these ideas, we can make the distinction between trusting in God and trusting God. Abraham was justified not because he believed in God, as these verses show, but he believed God. What an intimate relationship belief and faith is. When Abraham was promised something by God, Abraham believed God. It's an intimate relationship between God speaking and the person responding to the person who is speaking. That's exactly how intimate it was with Abraham. God made Abraham a promise, and Abraham believed God. Believed that he would not make a promise that he would not keep, and he believed he had the ability to keep it. Do you have relationships where you believe the other person? Or do you have a relationship where you believe in them? You believe they'll perform certain things, but you don't believe them, whereby you would live your life based upon what they tell you. How many relationships in this world have a faith in another person where they would rather stand alone? If that person were slandered in their hearing, they would rather withhold any belief in that slander until they could confirm it, because they had confidence about the other person. They believed the other person. Do you know any people who, if slander came about that person, you went to that person and said, "Is that true?" And they said, "That's not true." That you would take their side of it, regardless of the report? That you have that much trust in their character and integrity, that you actually trusted them and their word, regardless of what else might be said? Now we're getting a taste of what it means to trust God. Let God be true, but every man a liar. If the whole world slanders God because of its unbelief, those who trust God will not believe a slanderous report about God. It's just not the God I know. So I cannot believe those reports about God that the unbeliever may have. Abraham believed God. He entrusted himself to God. He committed himself to God's character, integrity. He trusted God. He believed God. If God said it, that was a sufficient basis upon which to believe it, because it was God who said it.
Paul says, I know whom I have believed. Unbelief thinks I know is sufficient. Faith has to take into account whom. I know whom I have believed. And the believing is different than the knowing. I know whom I have believed. Paul believed on a whom that he knew about. Just knowing and having knowledge is not faith. Faith is the willingness to accept that knowledge that is true and adjust your life accordingly. Abraham is the example given to the Jews and in the New Testament about faith. Remarkable man. God called him to a land, gave him a promise to give him that land, to give his descendants that land. He promised them that he would have a child of his own, even though Sarah was barren. It says Abraham believed God in Genesis. This is a quote from Genesis. It says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him as righteousness. Here's the word reckon or impute that is thrown around in theological circles. Some theological views hold that the righteousness of Christ is imputed to the sinner. That is how he is justified. That would really be a remarkable way of saving man. That really would be. If the obedience of Christ, if Christ's obedience upon earth, that he remained totally benevolent through all the circumstances through which he passed. Okay? If that could be imputed to my account, so that upon my account or my record, it would show total, constant, persevering benevolence, total obedience, conformity to the law. If that's what would do it, so that the law would look at me and say, well, he's not guilty because here's the record, albeit it's an imputed record, but nonetheless, I can't find any fault here, so we must let this person go, the penalty. That would be remarkable because that would be wonderful. Because if his obedience could be given to my account, then Jesus would never have to suffer the penalty for my sin, as some people view it. Because it would be no sin to my account to have to be punished for it. And if I was an unbeliever, and this obedience was available to me to be reckoned to my account, Jesus still would not have to die. Because if I'm an unbeliever, I'm not going to believe that he was punished for my sins, or that he has obedience given to be given to me. So even if he were to die, it could not be a punishment for sin, because I'm going to receive my own punishment. So under that scheme, if his obedience is given to me as a believer, he need not be punished, because no punishment would be due. And if I'm an unbeliever, he need not be punished, because I'm going to receive my own. So to have the idea constructed that I'm going to have the imputed obedience of Christ given to me and yet have Jesus punished for my sins as well is certainly a waste in the economy of God. Isn't it not? Needless, unreasonable, unnecessary to have Jesus suffer and be punished for sins that I'm not guilty of because I have those obedience imputed to my account? Know that none of that is reasonable. None of that is necessary. What is imputed, and there is an imputation in justification, what is imputed is clearly pointed out here in Romans 4. Abraham believed God, and it, his believing God, was reckoned or imputed to him as righteousness. In relationship to his government and his relationship to me and his treatment to me, he takes something and in regards to that something, or looking at that something and treating me according to what he sees, he imputes or reckons or credits or regards that in relationship to me when he justifies me.
that is my willingness to trust him. Abraham's willingness to receive the truth about God, that God revealed about himself. God referenced that believing state of mind, that willingness to accept the truth. And he credited that or reckoned that as righteousness or as total conformity to the law. That's what righteousness is. So the obedience of Christ is not reckoned to me as righteousness. Paul says that my faith, God reckons as righteousness or counts as righteousness. Why do you suppose he reckons that as righteousness? And when does he justify the sinner in relationship to seeing faith? When a person has faith, justifying faith. When a person trusts God in a saving sense that we're talking about here, in a justifying sense, how long after, when a person believes God, how long after does God justify him? A day later? A week later? A month later? Does God wait to see if that faith will obey? How long does he wait to see if that faith will obey? A week, a month, a year, 5 years? Remember, justification is the pardon of sin and the treating the sinner as if he had never sinned. How long does God wait from the time the sinner trusts God until God pardons his sin and treats him as if he had never sinned? God doesn't wait at all. God does not wait at all. Doesn't he have to see if this faith is sincere? Doesn't he have to see if this faith is going to work by love and overcome the world? Doesn't he have to? Does not God have to see that the person walks benevolent and in holiness for a while before he justifies it? No. Why? Because the faith that God reckons as righteousness is a kind of faith that God sees in the heart that controls the person. And that person is controlled by the truth that they have received, that they have believed. And that faith in God constrains him and controls him. And God, when he sees the faith, the kind that Abraham has, immediately pardons the sinner and begins to treat him as if he had never sinned. Some people say, you know what, I have believed God, and I still don't have a sense of his pardon. My conscience is still guilty. I see no evidences that I am free from my bondage to sin. I see no evidences I am free from selfishness. Why is that? Because it's not faith as the Bible is talking about. James says to the person he's conversing with in his mind, you say you have faith, well, so do the devils. Some people have a notion of what faith is, but the devils have a knowledge of the truth. They know, and they tremble at the knowledge that they have. But it's not a faith that God can count as righteousness. It is a knowledge, it is a hope, it is a feeling, it is something other than that which is faith from the heart. It's hard for me to describe an aspect of faith. Faith is not something, as I try to describe it, that a person has where they believe God, I'm supposing this to be the case of the description by other people. I believe God, but I have none of the evidences of what the Bible says is faith.
What should I do with my faith to make that change? And as I hear people describing it that way, I know that in my mind, they don't have faith. Because I know that I know that when your heart gives itself to the truth, the truth starts to control you. It is a heart's consent, an embracing of the truth. The promise that God would be merciful to sinners and wipe their sins away and forgive their iniquities and not count their sins against them. The selfish mind sees it and goes, oh, that's just what I need. That's what I need to stop feeling so bad and so guilty. And the selfish mind runs to that for a selfish end. And they don't have faith. They're simply trying to use a picked out promise to satisfy their hope. So many times it seems in my mind that people who say they have not faith, who say they have faith, but it doesn't bring about the results of faith. One of the great reasons in my mind is that they are not persuaded that they are sinners without hope under law. They view the mercy and grace of God as an added benefit or blessing to have in this world. Something to add to themselves is a blessing, but not a necessity for one who is lost in sin. The mercy and grace of God would be a wonderful blessing to have, but they're doing okay pretty much without that, but the conscience comes in and temper flares up and it would be, I know I need forgiveness, so I'll just repent and ask God for forgiveness. But there's no sense that under law they're hopeless, and that without God's mercy and pardon, their damnation is sure. There's no confidence. There's no real belief. There's no real faith. There's no real confidence that they're lost. When there's no confidence, when the person has never received the truth of what the law reveals, they've never seen their heart as totally alien from God and at war with God, what if a person were at war with another person? But through some mechanism in their mind, they just refused to believe it. And the cause of the warfare was their own. They caused it. And yet they try to take the attitude that, you know, you tell me that person over there is a good person and they have many blessings for me, many good things for me. I'd like those too. When the person refuses to come to terms in their own mind and acknowledge that they're at war with that person, then they will go to that person that they want a blessing from on an entirely different footing than according to the truth. They will think there's some goodies there that this person is willing to give. Well, I want them. That's sufficient reason for him to give them to me. And they refuse to acknowledge this underlying relationship that they're at war with that person. In relationship to God, the great gift that God has is for people who are at war with them, with Him. And until a person is convicted in their mind and convinced in their own mind that truth, then the offer of pardon and forgiveness, you know, sounds rather mystical. I really don't know why I need pardon and forgiveness. I know I'm feeling guilty and stuff, but I need
I need a pardon for that act of sin and that act of sin. And they don't recognize they need a pardon for being rebellious against God and His law. They need God Himself to be reconciled to. In the progression of a person ceasing from self-deception and ending up being reconciled to God, nobody will ever become reconciled to God until they have the influence of the law upon their mind. Until they see and are willing to believe that they have transgressed God's law and God dare not let them off from punishment. That their sin is so rebellious, at such enmity at God, that their unbelief is such a travesty against God. Until the mind really gets a knowledge and a sense and believes the enormity of sin, then believing that God will pardon you is a trivial matter. Trivial. Well, you know, I didn't do anything so bad. Surely He should pardon that. When the mind is burdened down with the knowledge of the true nature of your sin against God, the holiness of God and the holiness of His law and the rightness of the command and the justness of what the law commands and the justness of God in upholding that law, and that His love would be violated if he did not maintain the justice of that command. When the mind under God's law begins to justify God in putting upon the sinner the penalty that He has put upon him, until a mind comes to that state, when it does come to that state, the mind begins to see as incomprehensible any way to be reconciled with God. When the law works upon the mind and the person is willing to start being honest with the truth, starts to being honest with himself in regards to God's law and God as a holy God, that works upon the mind until the person, if he's willing to remain honest, will begin and come to a point where he will see it incomprehensible. How can God, who I know is just and benevolent and holy, and I know His law is holy, just, and good, and when the truth of all that sinks upon the sinner's mind, and he begins to sink down under the weight of that, the sinner actually begins to think, there is no way possible for me to be reconciled with God. That state of mind, it is produced by a willingness to believe the truth regarding God's law and God's character, brings about in the state of the sinner a true state where he begins to view his case as hopeless, because it is, under that law. And the idea that God should forgive becomes the notion, or developed in this way: God, if you were simply to forgive me, you would no longer be just. When the holiness of God is raised up properly in the mind, and that it is duty and obligation, it is justice demands that he maintain that law, and he punished lawbreakers. When properly seen, the mind of any sinner begins to justify God, and almost cringe from the idea for God to pardon, because that suggests that God is not going to uphold His law. Now, here's what I'm getting at. Faith in a sinner towards a God whom he knows he's at war with, faith
And that God, the only way it moves from confidence in that I will get what I deserve to confidence that I will not, is a revelation of His mercy and His grace, and that Jesus came to make it possible for me to go from what I deserve to what I don't. And in a context of being in a state where you're absolutely persuaded what you deserve, and that God is just in giving you what you deserve, and you no longer complain about the fact that God is going to execute the penalty upon sinners, but that you receive that as only just and right, and then to have it opened up to your understanding by God's Spirit, that apart from law, He offers pardon and grace because of the shed blood of Christ. Because the mind has become persuaded of the holiness of God, the justice of God, the rightness of God, and upholding His law, the foundation is laid to also believe that when God promises mercy, grace, He will be just as faithful to give that as He would be to be faithful to give the penalty. In that context, under those conditions, the heart moves to embrace the promise of mercy. That movement to embrace the promise of mercy offered by a God that you've come to believe will do what is just and holy. That movement to embrace His offer, promise of mercy and grace, is what is called faith or trust. But it is in the context of one who knows their true state under the law and has stopped to justify themselves and started to justify God in being just in executing the penalty upon sinners. It is the sinner where in his proper place is under the law, hearing that God has made provision to offer mercy and grace. And like the prodigal son, he comes to his senses, recalling his father's true character, and he returns. Only this time it's under a promise of mercy and grace. So in that state, the sinner sees his only hope is to receive this free gift of mercy and grace. And that the blood of Jesus met a condition for God's government so that it's possible without God becoming unholy and unjust. Now that is the action of faith of a sinner in receiving grace and mercy. That is different than the usual description of a person saying, well, I have faith, I'm a Christian, but I just don't have any evidences of being born again. The offer of mercy and grace to one who is in unbelief is a trivial matter, because the person does not believe they deserve the penalty that they deserve. They just think there's something wrong that needs a small adjustment. There's one act I did. One day I had a bad day. So, grace, in many cases, the heart has not been prepared for grace because the law has not done its work. And that's what Paul is doing in this letter, having the law do its work, so that when he starts talking about grace and justification as a gift, it is offered to those who have their own conscience ringing loud in the ears, yes, under law you have no hope. You are confident that God is a righteous and just God. He has a law. He has proclaimed it. You have violated it. And you have confidence that this God will uphold it. And Paul says, I also have a promise for you that you can take and believe in that this God has done something so remarkable that He can now pardon and forgive apart from the works of law on the basis of confidence in His promise. So Paul takes Abraham and his willingness to believe God and uses it as our example of the kind of faith, what it means to trust God in the relationship to the sinner being justified. Now, James takes us one step further to help us. James says, "You say you have faith without works. I say I show you my faith by my works." So let's have a contest. You who say you have faith with no works, show me your faith. And his listeners think for a few moments and say, "How can I show my faith? Claim to have faith without works. Show me your faith." There's no way to show faith that works. James says, "Therefore, I will show you my faith by my works." You can't show me your faith without your works, can you? No. Then there's no way for you or me to know if you have faith. But I'll show you my faith by my works. And then he brings in Abraham too. And he says, "Was not Abraham our father justified by works? When he took up his son, whom God said to offer up to him," he said, "he took up his son and took him up to the mountain and was going to sacrifice him. And God provided the ram as a burnt offering, and his son was not sacrificed. But Abraham's works, Abraham's immediate obedience to the word of God, demonstrated he was in a state of receiving all of God's truth for him. He was in a state of trusting God." Now, Abraham was called to offer Isaac about 15 years after Abraham believed God and it was counted to him as righteousness. James points out that this work that Abraham did when God spoke and said, "Give me your son," his immediate response, his immediate obedience to the very point of ready to sacrifice his son, proved the kind of faith that he had. God saw in Abraham's heart, when Abraham believed God, that kind of faith. So he counted it as righteousness. 15 years later, when he called him to sacrifice his son, Abraham demonstrated the faith he had had since back there when he believed God. James says, "See, this is how we know Abraham had faith, because he obeyed God. You see, by his works, he trusted God." God sees the heart and justifies a sinner the instant a sinner has that faith, that trust in God. That regardless of what comes down the road, regardless of what God may further reveal as His will for your life, you are willing to receive that from the hand of God as you are willing from the first time you received from the hand of God whatever He said to you. Faith that God counts as righteousness is the faith, the commitment of the heart, the entrusting of the heart to God in such a way that it is a commitment from now through eternity. When a man makes a promise to a woman standing before friends, "I will love you, cherish you, till death do us part," all those promises, those aren't temporary promises. Those are vows. Those are commitments. When a man makes a promise like that to his wife, it doesn't matter the style, the height, the weight, the shape, the color of the eyes, the color of the hair, the cute smile of any other woman in the world. All those are off bounds. And that was decided when he made the vows. He didn't decide that 10 years later, when some cute young thing starts winking at him and flirting with him and making suggestive remarks, he doesn't sit there going, "I wonder if I should follow this up or not." That was decided when he made the vow. That was off limits. Right? That was decided. It's a done deal when he makes the vow. We have a notion that Christianity is involved in you make a vow and then you're faced with a situation where you make another vow, and it's kind of a
a vow of the moment, you know, a vow a day kind of relationship. No. When Abraham believed God, he entrusted his soul to God. He received the truth and the promise of God. He had the willingness to believe this God and his promises, and it was a done deal. Whatever God asked him to do thereafter, it was already a done deal. It was a blank check. God, whatever you say to me, I believe you're a God of truth. I believe you're a God of benevolence. I believe you would never ask anything of me that was not for the greatest good. I believe you would not do anything to me that would not be for the greatest good. I have complete confidence in you, God, and I give my confidence to you. It's a rested, settled fact. It's a done deal. So it doesn't matter what comes along after that. The person will do it. And James says that's the evidence that the person had a faith that God would count as righteousness. Because by their words, by their actions, by their responses to God's providence, by their response to God's commands, by their response to further revealed light, you see them always obeying God. That's how you know. That's how you know if you have justifying faith. Because you find in yourself this willingness to follow Him in obedience, springing from an initial commitment to Him of faith and confidence. Why does He count it as righteousness? Because in that kind of faith is every seed of obedience and righteousness. Confidence in God has in it all of the attributes of benevolence and obedience, just waiting for the occasion to bring them out. When Abraham believed God, he had the kind of faith and commitment and entrustment to God in seed, in kernel, in principle, of the willingness to sacrifice his son. That was 15 years later when the occasion was brought to him to do so. When you trust God, you have within you all of the kernels of benevolence. All it's waiting for is various occasions to bring to your life, to your circumstances, occasions by which this benevolence will be forced to come out. You'll be put under situations in which patience will be required. You'll be put under situations in which jealousy must be put aside. Any possibility for it? You'll be put under situations where kindness. You'll be put under situations where envying is not going to be any good. You'll be put situations where love will demonstrate itself. It'll bear all things. It will hope all things. There'll be peace. There'll be joy. When there's confidence in God, all of the attributes of benevolence are sitting waiting for God's providential workings to bring about circumstances, and these will manifest themselves. Same thing in unbelief. A person in unbelief, you can't tell by looking at a person if they're in unbelief. But God's providential workings put them in circumstances where their selfishness, their unbelief, their rejection of truth just will manifest itself. How do you know what's in a bucket? You kick it over. You find out what's in a bucket. Well, when a person believes God, every once in a while that bucket gets kicked, and out comes benevolence, faith, confidence, obedience. A person in unbelief, once in a while their bucket gets kicked, and out comes anger, strife, jealousy, unbelief, selfishness. So God counted Abraham's faith as righteousness because it was the kind of faith that would, in all circumstances, act righteously, obediently, benevolently. Because that kind of faith is righteousness. And that's how he secures the sinner's obedience, is securing this kind of faith. Some of you faced, and will face this year, the holidays again, and you'll be faced with the same pressures that you faced this year again. But throughout the year, you will be weekly, monthly, daily, maybe hour by hour, in the circumstances you're in, be faced with various things. It will simply be a kicking of your bucket to see what's inside. That's all it is. It is God's benevolence kicking over the bucket of the unbeliever to call his attention to his unbelief, his selfishness. And to the believer, it is to bring out and to manifest God's character in this world. Why does evangelical faith imply an evangelical life? Why is it called saving faith? Because the kind of faith that Abraham had, that God considers as righteousness, is the kind of faith waiting to obey, waiting to demonstrate its love for God, because it has entrusted itself to God, because the heart has been brought up out of self-interest to consider and give itself to a greater interest than its own. And what has brought that about? Seeing God's benevolent heart offering to this wretched sinner pardon and grace as a gift. Why does it necessarily involve repentance? Because the work of the law has made it evident to the sinner his true state, his true rebellion against God, his true war with God. And he sees that yet this loving God, through great sacrifice, offers as a gift pardon and grace. He sees it only just. Having been encountering the great justness of God through the law, he sees it only right and just that he give up his rebellion against God. He sees only right and just that he do so whether there's forgiveness or not. But his confidence in this glorious, gracious, benevolent God brings about a heart completely willing to walk away from selfishness and become like the God whom he begins to trust. Truth is a marvelous thing because it influences every mind, one way or the other. And to those who give themselves to trust him, his truth begins to create and bring about the very image of his Son in the heart that trusts him. But it is through faith we are saved. Let's pray. Father, how glorious you made man, all moral beings, to feed off of the truth, to be stimulated by the truth. What a wonderful government your moral government is. With this great liberty and great responsibility and great opportunity to love you and not just be a mechanical animal that can do nothing but obey our instincts. How glorious you've made man. And what great liability you made him that is able to deny the truth and walk in unbelief and live according to a lie. Surely, Lord, there must be great good in using those means. Some great good that you are going to bring such glory to you and such good to man that you would take that risk, suffer the liability. It even cost you your own dear son that he would suffer and die because of unbelief, rejection of truth. I thank you, Lord, that obedience to the law and refusal to obey the law did not bring us to an end of hope. But you had another way by which to secure righteousness within us. And that is to induce us to trust you. Marvelous what you've done, Lord. How gracious to give to the ungodly at the very moment that they are willing to trust you and believe what is true about you. You're willing to give them favor and mercy. When you see a heart willing to give the kind of faith that includes in it the kernels of obedience and love, submission to your will, Thank you that you do not wait and wait and wait before you see acts of obedience and acts of love. That you can see the heart that gives itself to you in confidence. And from that moment, you pour out your grace and mercy. Stir our hearts today to see the truth. The unbelief is rebellion against the truth. Not just a neutral zone of ignorance, but a rebellion against known truth. Help us to see, Lord, also that holiness is simply walking in all the truth that we know, with the confidence that whatever you reveal to us will be for good, that you will have our obedience, Lord, because we made the commitment long ago. Or if necessary, Lord, we make the commitment today as a final commitment, a concluding commitment, made out of trust in you, that no other interest shall come before thee, because we trust you and your character and your will.